So I'm glad that Srini told me my job. Actually, what I'm going to say is slightly repetitive of making some of the comments that he's made. But I wanted to bring up one thing first, just kind of a historical reminder that I was thinking about the other night. Also, I wanted to thank Srini and Bill for inviting me here. It's a pretty nice spot to hold a meeting. It's almost 30 years, almost to the day, that first direct numerical simulations were done with Steve Orzag and Stu Patterson at NCAR. And I guess they were both guests of NCAR at the time. They were visitors, and Doug Lilly, Chuck Leith, and Jack Herring were the ones that invited them out. And it turned out at the same time that that Stu and Steve were doing that, Jim Deardorff was doing the first large eddy simulations of turbulence. And so there was kind of a sea change going on in the study of turbulence about that time, all of it instigated at NCAR. And you were there right about that time. You started about 70 or so? Or
72.
72, okay. So,
Stu became director of the
Center. Right, right.
As soon as he got there.
Yeah. Yeah, so... their first papers came out in 70, 71, I think, something like that. Yeah. Anyway, I wanted to do one thing. I usually don't like semantics, but I think everybody here probably would go along with this, but there's a lot of papers that come out that mention direct numerical simulation and mean a lot of different things. So I thought at least we ought to be on the same page when we start. And I'm thinking of numerical solution of a turbulent flow in which all of the dynamically significant lengths and timescales are simulated accurately. So taking that as a definition that we're dealing with. And so in particular, you know, all the stuff that people have talked about already, 3D isotropic decay is a candidate for this. Even some nice work on two-dimensional turbulence, if you talk about it as two-dimensional turbulence or quasi-geostrophic turbulence, I think it's a good candidate for the methodology. But what I'm trying to eliminate more are simulations where people say take a 3D jet and do a two-dimensional simulation of it at high Reynolds numbers and stuff, and I wouldn't consider that in the framework of what we're speaking about. And large eddy simulation. In fact, I'd almost think of that last one as you've averaged over one dimension, and so it's more like a large eddy simulation or a hybrid of it. It's a good topic, but we're not going to be discussing it. And a lot of this all comes down to limitations in the methodology that we'll be dealing with. You know, it's basically what type of length and time scales that we can deal with in simulations. And it deals with the geometries and everything else. But I guess Steve and Stu started out with their about 1 to 15 was the range of scales that they could deal with. And I think it was 32-cube calculation with some types of truncation. And we're now up to 1 to several hundred. And so we have to figure out what we can do with those type of limitations. But we have all the advantages of numerical simulation. So it has limitations, but there's a lot of advantages that we all know about. Advantages in numerical simulation, like we have all the information available that we want, every point in space and time, and change parameters easily within the resolution. And we can do a lot of things that are impossible in the lab, like Srini's mentioning forcing and adjusting virtual origins, and there are all kinds of things that people can think about that you can do with a numerical simulation that you can't do in the lab. And so we have these weaknesses and strengths, and a lot of this is going to be dealing with how do we take advantage of the methodology. And again, I haven't had a lot of discussions with Bill and Srini about the objectives and everything, and I got a little bit more information from Srini's. But we'll be talking about what are the limitations, how they affect the results, can the limitations be ameliorated at all, what are the best uses of the methodology in predicting turbulence, We may want to include predicting transition as well here, because a number of problems that you do, like, say, if you really do a turbulent jet, you may want to predict it through transition to turbulence. And, of course, usefulness depends on questions asked. And so I just wanted to throw out some possible issues, and a little bit like Srini was doing, and whether direct simulations are a good methodology to attack them or not. And like properties of high Reynolds number boundary layers, I think people would probably say that it isn't a good approach. In fact, experiments are iffy on that right now. There's a lot of controversy there. Or predicting turbulence in complex configurations like flow around the car or something, probably not there either. Then maybe I could get some more argument here, but whether you can use direct numerical simulations to accurately determine model parameters, say in a K-epsilon or a RANS model. Some people, maybe there are some parameters that you could, maybe not. I think it could be, might be a lot of differences of opinion there. Whether you can use it to determine theoretical parameters, scaling exponents and things like that, maybe. Whether you can use direct numerical simulations to determine sub-grid scale modeling assumptions, I think there is a pretty good use of it, especially the a priori use. One of the points I'm trying to make is that a lot of it depends on what questions you ask, especially with the methodology. And then kind of something that Srini referred to, I think a really good use is to explore basic physics in new problems in simple configurations, and ask questions like, can turbulence in stably stratified fluids support counter-gradient fluxes? And if so, why? How can they do that? If someone's only dealt with non-stratified flows, it's kind of counterintuitive. Or what happens if you start rotating turbulence? Does rotation suppress the turbulence, or does it enhance the turbulence, or what? And it turns out sometimes one and sometimes the other. So that, I think, definitely has a role to play. But compressible flows, how does a shock wave affect turbulence and vice versa? Bob knows a lot more about that, but maybe not, that direct numerical simulation would be good. The question to always deal with is, can the results be scaled up to higher Reynolds numbers, or if you're dealing with reacting flows, higher Damkohler numbers or whatever. Sometimes it can and sometimes it can't. So there's a lot of different issues. There's a methodology there that has its strengths and limitations, and hopefully that's what we're going to be dealing with then. What problems can be addressed? What are the best ones to be addressed? What improvements can be made in the methodology? At least in talking to Bill, we're really interested in identifying the strengths and weaknesses of the methodology, how best to use it and improve it. And so it's not so much, we're not so much interested in the latest and greatest results, except as to how they bring out some of these issues. And as Srini said, the program has a lot of time for discussion, and so don't hesitate to make comments, ask questions, things like that. So I'm going to stop here and then let the next speaker take over, unless somebody wants to comment on any of this stuff now.
I'm not quite sure. We want to accept the definition with the DNS.
Fine. That's fine. That's fine. Yeah.
I think this definition is a narrow definition. It's very useful. If we use that definition, essentially, except the spectrum matter, we cannot win. Spectrum matter only for isotropic thermal, only for simple shear flows. Otherwise, we don't see any, maybe channel flow, you do Chebyshev or something. If we take this definition, we cannot run it. Essentially, we say jet flow, I don't know any other numerical method can resolve all skill based on the other solution. I would open mind to see, say, why not we accept some more broad definition, without doing large editing, without doing subgrid modeling, things like that, we still view, possibly, I argue, mm-hmm. still view as directional measurement. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. I guess like Parviz Moin would argue that in terms of numerical methods, wouldn't he? That he uses now higher-order finite difference methods and feels they're a lot more useful than spectral methods in a lot of problems. Yeah, and in fact, there's other methods, too. Yeah.
All relevant scales. So suppose you capture the resolution. If I give you a resolution, say, once you get the smallest scale in spectrum metric, you can capture the
right.
You can get the 64. You have all scales. Except the spectrum metric, you can do it. Tell me any other method you can do it. I don't know.
If you give it double width, you increase your smallest, except the spectrum, I don't see any other method to do it. In fact, you say all scales, you've probably ruled out any calculation. Well, I guess I said all dynamically relevant scales.
That's really good because this is an example, you know. We've done some calculations with isotropic turbulence, and if you want to get the energy decay and stuff like that, you have one resolution. But if you get into reacting flows, it turns out that the dissipation rates of the scalars are the most important thing, and they're much harder to resolve. And so then you worry about, then you need more resolution to do, to answer the questions that you want. So it depends a lot on what questions you ask.
I think you left the door open for large eddy simulation because you said...
Yeah.
To simulate all the dynamically significant scales, and so we need to decide what's
But the trouble though with your comment, Srini, is that you can just go the Navier-Stokes equation, not put any new physics in, but new physics can come out if you don't do the numerics well. No, it is, though. Yeah. But that'll be an issue here. Jack. I mean, that's what people have concluded. I mean, people have concluded with isotropic decay that if you have a cutoff, you know, above a Kolmogorov scale, you know, Steve Pope has a round number for that and stuff, that you can accurately simulate it. Although, if you're interested in chemical reactions, again, you have to push that a little bit higher. And I think, like Bill is interested in skewness spectra and stuff like that, that you may need even more. Yeah, you even need more.
But those are available to PDFs too.
Yeah, right.
Can we take an operational definition and we can compare it and say, well, I've got some grid, I get some answer, some statistics, one that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Refine the grid by a factor of two in every direction. I get the same amount of statistics. Well, that's it. I'm the DNS for those statistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somebody says, I want a different statistic.
That's a good...
But there's a question on the other end, too, right? And I know this is one of the Bill's interested in, and that is, you know, how big are the domains?
That's implied here too.
I argue that in fact there's lots of useful things that you can do, that, even in the context of having a finite domain. And it's actually a much harder question whether you can aim to be big enough to be able to all these dynamically relevant skills. So my operational lesson about DNS is that I'm solving the Navier-Stokes equation packing the sunset home.
Mm-hmm. One reason to bring it up, just the name, direct numerical simulation, is kind of a misnomer in a sense. But that's what we have right now.
Well, you do things like random Boltzmann equations. Solve certain equations almost exactly and correspond to them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm sorry, Jeff, were you?
Like CAs and stuff.
No, not Thomas. Mainly random Boltzmann equations.
Yeah.
So
another.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll wait for your talk then. Yeah. Yeah. In some sense, it's another numerical method, but I think there are other ways too.
It's interesting, actually. Shane touched on this in his little beginning. That we've as a community spent a lot of effort figuring out how to solve these equations very well.
Mm-hmm.
And think about why is that? Why does that even make sense to do? And I think one way to think about it is that we're really spoiled by the fact that magnetic system was in such a very good approximation to the physics of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes sense to spend a lot of effort to figure out how to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a problem like simulation of roots of dark matter, where you don't even really even know what it is, your motivation to really do a good job on those, on whatever equations you pose, is perhaps not so high.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the lattice seems to be the first one, the biggest numerical method. It's very different from Monte Carlo.
Right.
But again, clearly nobody would be spending millions of dollars doing that unless they believe wholeheartedly. Great. Starting point.
Right. And certainly,
there is a lot of the methodology that's spilling over, though, into astrophysics and things like that. I mean, at least on our campus, I see people doing direct numerical simulation, I would call it, of a planetary nebula, for instance. And and I'm sure it's happening in other fields too.
There are other areas one of my former students now is working on in biophysics in the genome project, and he thinks that some of the tools he learned as a student in prison are very appropriate for that kind of work. But then we as a community haven't had any background at all. Perhaps one of the things I've been
So you will see some simulations there too, I presume.
I imagine.
Yeah.
We've already benefited from this exchange with the galaxy people because the paper has been circulated about the fact that we should all slack off and wait for the
shall we adjourn and go to the
Marvelous little thing.
the ones that I put up, you mean, or?
Yeah, I don't know.
I was thinking of going ahead with that, and okay. So Ms. Wang, so let's have a talk now on some of the work that from the University of Buffalo. Sunny at Buffalo, and this.